Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota in Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit Toyota on Nicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at LexusofLexington.com. Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
I'm a shot in the dark, very sort of spark.
Welcome back to The Whaley Show. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, kids, here we go. Episode 16. I have a treat for you today. After this chatty first segment, we're going to go into a freewheeling, and I don't know if freewheeling is a good word for it. An attempt at an honest conversation between me and my friend Noel Maring, who has a new article in The Federalist called "Here's the Danger of Weaponizing Legitimate Suffering for Revenge." And we talk about her article and about the issue around Kavanaugh, and that goes into a longer conversation about, you know, just the modern world and the way we've kind of, you know, weaponized activism and all the different things in about the way that we're kind of treating words. And, you know, and I love the interview because it's kind of an awkward and very real conversation between two people who are friends where, I think it's a good time. I think it'll be fun to listen to. Before that, I just want to just kind of give you little updates here, about my world. So fall has fell, and I could not be happier. The weather has changed. We dropped 10 degrees 2 days in a row. It is bearable outside and I'm not sweating. Every time I walk outside, it is super, super nice. We have entered the season. God let it be a long one, that I don't hate living in this state. Just like weather-wise. It's so beautiful here in the fall, and it feels so good. Growing up, I just love fall because it's just the humidity drops. It's not cold yet. It's like the whole world is air-conditioned, and it's into my favorite colors. So, though I have kind of lost my, penchant for those earth tones and those fall, I'm an autumn. I don't quite have the penchant for those hunter greens and burgundies that I used to, but it was the '90s, you know, it was the '90s. Hunter green was the color of the '90s, that and gray flannel or something. Tomorrow is the big homecoming for Southeast Missouri State University. It'll go right past my building. Much fun will be had by all, lots of parades and public drinking and all kinds of shenanigans. And I will not be here. Now I would be able to be here and watch the bacchanalia from above in my new office, which is almost ready. The landlord has been here patching walls, painting. He's gotten all the stuff out of there that I didn't want, that was left by the last guy. I left all the stuff that I wanted to keep from the last guy still in there. So, it's kind of getting cool. It's kind of coming together. I saw it. It smells like paint. It's all white and shiny, and it smells like paint. He's going to have the carpets cleaned And so hopefully by the next time I do this show, I'll be doing it from my lofty perch in my new office. I'm super excited about that. Lots going on in Calyx land, building all kinds of cool, conceptual tools and packages and stuff for ways to communicate what we can do with people. Especially moving in a strong direction towards campus ministry. So if you are, in any way affiliated with a campus ministry, and you'd like to get early adoption of some possible cool stuff, reach out to me, via Calyxland, calyx.org, and, just click anywhere there and fill out a form or something. And, we'll get back with you. There's a shameless plug for the way I keep a roof on things. The mom report. Mom's tearing it up. You know, mom is getting more and more independent all the time. Mom, while I was in California, mom got the making her tea thing down. And it's interesting because I think mom like wants to make her tea now, and she plays it off like she likes being independent and it's what she can do. And I'm sure that's part of it. The truth be told, mom likes the way she makes a tea better than the way I make her tea, because she makes it sweeter and she leaves a tea bag in it the whole time she's drinking it. I come from coffee house land where you steep for 2, 3, or 4 minutes, depending on the tea. And then you time it and you pull it out and you're not wanting to over extract. Mom over extracts that black tea and counteracts all that bitterness with a ton of sugar. Well, a ton of stevia now. So, she's been making that tea, and, we got a new chair for mom. We got the, lift recliner for mom. So mom was having some knee pain and some different issues from her having to get up out of this recliner we got for her that was kind of low. So we got her, we wanted a little higher, a little firmer recliner, and we got the lift kind. So she's got a little remote control and it's like, and it picks you up and it puts your feet up so she can get up without having to use her knees. Now we're still going to have to keep making her do some like these little like unweighted squat things she does with a chair, but to keep those muscles rolling. But yeah, so it's pretty funny. So I walk in the room sometimes and there's this recliner that is like robot, like up in the air. It looks like Go-Go Gadget recliner. I put a picture on Facebook and I said, things are picking up around here. Get it. Because it's a thing that's doing the picking up, and things are being picked up. You know, it's a play on words. It's a double play on words. inside the mom report, the Mr. Man report, the Gabriel the Cat report. Two things have happened in Catland here in the last week. So I bought the cat. I've been buying a cat grain-free, like nice cat food. Why? I mean, I've got a soft spot for the cat now myself, but our cat has feline leukemia. Now, as best we can tell, he's asymptomatic, but he can't be around other cats. And he's completely, you know, he's healthy, but he's sick and it could kick in at some point if he's not fed, you know, if something goes wrong. I mean, he's not fed correctly or like doesn't take care of himself. So, and the little crap makes my mom happy, and my mom needs as much as she can to be happy. So I want this cat to be around as long as possible. So I've been feeding the cat good food, but it's expensive. And Aldi had grain-free cat food for $6 a bag. And I'm like, yes. So I bought like 2 bags of it. I was going to go home, make sure he liked it. Then I was going to come back and buy cases of the stuff. Right. And so I got this and I started noticing that he just wasn't eating. And then it turns out like 3 days, this cat just walked around crying and wouldn't eat. He just didn't like this food. Smelled identical to the other food. It looks identical. It's a little smaller pieces. This cat would not eat. So after 3 days, I just like poured the bowl back in the bag, set it off to give to our landlord who has a bunch of cats, and went and bought a different bag. I like cheaper, nastier cat food that they had at the best they had at the local grocery store a couple blocks away. Brought it back. Cat is eating like you've never seen. The cat ate a whole bowl yesterday And I filled it up last night so that he'd have something to eat overnight. I got up this morning. He was crying. I go in there. There's like six pieces left. Like he ate a whole bowl of cat food overnight. So I'm letting him play catch up this week. Then we're going to have to start dialing back because, you know, he's already heavy when he jumps up on mom. And the other thing is the new chair has a gap between where the footrest is and the chair. And the old one was like solid. I'm okay with the suffering of the cat gives my mom joy too, because he jumps up sometimes and then tries to get to her and goes through the hole because the blanket's covering it, and he has this crazy look on his face and he's like slapping his hands and everything. He's safe. It's not gonna hurt the cat to like ride a blanket down through a 1 foot hole, but you know, anyway, Mr. Man is having to contend with the new chair as well. So that's the Mr. Man report and the mom report. Looks like I'm going to probably be heading either to, still a possibility of going to New Mexico and possible parts west at the end of the month. If not, hopefully going to go to the promised land, Columbia, Missouri, my old stomping grounds, and see Father Reginald Wolford and the lovely and talented Perry West, ladies and gentlemen. So hopefully I'll drag my gear with me and we'll get a good long interview with my old friend Perry West, including maybe some live music and playing of some unreleased songs or something. Who knows? We'll see what we can get Perry talked into. All right, so we're going to go to my interview with my friend Noelle Mehring. Her article is in The Federalist. It is called "Here's the Danger of Weaponizing Legitimate Suffering for Revenge" in the culture section of The Federalist. And Noelle is like one of my friends that, like, I have all these friends like Hope Schneer, Allie Kavanaugh, her, where they do these things like they're wives and mothers, and there's like a bunch of kids to take care of and stuff that I don't have to deal with at all. And they still, like, in the process of doing all that, they still manage to make brilliance or beauty or do something. And Noelle's turning into quite the little writer here. She's just publishing all kinds of cool stuff, right? You know, almost every week there's a new article coming out. So I've been wanting to get her on. I've talked about her articles before, and I'm such a fan of her and Adam and their whole family. So it's gonna be fun to have them out. So coming back after the break, which will probably be, I don't even know if we're going to have commercials or not, so it might be like right now. Coming back after the break, we are going to have an interview with Noelle Mehring, and that went kind of longer than we thought, so I just let it break. So that'll be the end of your, that's the last thing we're going to do is an interview. So I will see you guys next week after the interview. Thanks for coming out, and now let's go to the break and come back with Noelle Mehring.
Lift my shoes, oh, the only ones with souls. Then bold as we will walk down Massachusetts blocks. We're free, oh, what?
Welcome back to The Whaley Show. As promised, we are here with my good friend, the lovely and talented Noelle Mehring. And welcome, Noelle.
Hey, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
Dude, that was a very awkward. I kind of stumbled. Like, my friend, lovely, who's talented, and
Mehring.
I'm not used to having, you know, writers of your caliber on the shows.
Oh, brother, that's not true.
I haven't had any writers on the show. That's not true. On this show, not on the Whaley Show.
Roger Thompson.
I've had a bunch. But that was, no, we never did get that.
Oh,
we
never
tried,
did.
And we had tech difficulty. That was for the counter position. That's technically a different show.
So, oh, okay.
That was for the first 300 episodes or so were a different show. This is, you're on the new, this is the new new.
This you're is, this is cutting new. Edge. I this only will do edge. The cutting edge.
Exactly. So my friend Noelle Mehring, wrote in addition to being an amazing wife and mother, and killer cocktail party thrower. She wrote this beautiful and interesting, well, I don't know if it's beautiful in the Greek sense of the word. This solid article and for the Federalists called Here's the Danger of Weaponizing Legitimate Suffering for Revenge, which is about Netflix. No, I'm kidding. It's about Kavanaugh, of course.
The scourge of Netflix.
So I thought this was a really, really, really well written, really, really well argued article. And I thought, okay, you know what? Let's just get Noelle on here. Because what I normally would do is go, okay, next thing I want to talk about on the show is my friend Noelle, who's really cool and really beautiful and really smart. And she wrote this cool article. And then I would try to like tell them what you said and put a link in the show notes. And they would go, God, she doesn't sound good at all. And it's really, I'm just an idiot. And I wouldn't have got the argument right. So I thought, you know what? Let's just go straight to the source, get you on the show. All right. So in this article, you basically make an argument about the weaponizing of the tragedy and suffering of women kind of in the scapegoat of Brett Kavanaugh, so to speak. So you basically lay out your argument for the lovely listeners in podcasting here.
Sure. So you did it well. I'll expand on it a little bit, just that I noticed that, along with a lot of other people noticing this, that it seemed like there was what took over the conversation were stories of women's personal accounts of having suffered abuse at the hands of a man in their lives. Tragic, you know, heart-wrenching stories, but then connecting it to Brett Kavanaugh in a way that was bizarre. Even the New York Times, I don't know if you saw that article, it was much discussed from this past weekend, the woman writing it, I think she opened it up with some line, something like, after women basically went to the to DC and slit their wrists and all but let their blood run out all over the Senate, they still voted, you know, to confirm Kavanaugh.
I did hear about that. Yeah.
Which, and it sort of was emblematic to me of the way we've been talking about sufferings and applying it to this particular circumstance and how unjust that was, right? Because, you know, really, you know, women, a particular woman's story is pretty much means exactly nothing if we're, you know, trying to figure out whether or not this particular man did something. And the number of stories coming out, the collectivizing of, you know, the search for this like collective justice and this particular person to, like you said, be a scapegoat for their personal pain and bear all of that for him to bear all of that just seemed like, and it is actually a total miscarriage of what justice ought to be, right? So I thought that phenomenon of talking about it in that way, which has been happening, you know, I mean, obviously this is just basically identity politics. This is not new, but it just seemed more strident and like louder than I remember it before. And I guess partially because the stakes are so high, but even people who I don't know, you know, probably when I call themselves Marxists were, you know, sort of just jumping in on this, just this type of collectivizing of guilt, you know, victims and victim culture. So, you know, I guess my point of my article is just that's if we want justice, we have to apply just principles, right? We can't use injustice to resolve injustice, if that makes sense.
Right. Well, and I think that this is identity politics. This is in the particular, but I think that this is actually something. This is a step back. This is in the Porphyrian tree of modern politics. This is a genus that identity politics can be a particular application or a species of, right? And this is what's become analogical politics, right? This is, you don't deal with a person. You don't deal with this particular vote or this particular policy. It's people like this who do these kind of things to people like us who suffer these kind of things. So we collectively have to stand up to them. And because he is them. Now, this is kind of played out through politics. He's a white male Christian Catholic cisgender empowered, wealthy blah, blah, blah. You could just get, just
checks every box your, of privilege. Yeah.
Check all your privilege boxes in the inner, the negative side of intersectionality, so to speak. Right. He is all those things. Therefore, we have to stand up to him with our stories of suffering of people who are like him. And that is considered relevant. That's considered high-minded and even self-evident to an aspect of this country.
Right, right. And I think that most of them would probably say, you know, that, well, I am also thinking that she's believable. And, you know, I don't think that if you really talk to them one-on-one that they would say, this is my whole evidence for his guilt. But there is something really insidious about the trotting out all of these stories in this context that are totally irrelevant. And we wouldn't accept it in other circumstances, but it seems justifiable with him because he checks the boxes of privilege. And that just strikes me as super unprincipled, right? Because it just means that if you can't apply a principle universally, then the principle doesn't mean anything.
Speaking of that, I'm sorry, I cut you off. I didn't mean to mansplain.
I was done.
I'm mansplaining.
How dare you?
I'm mansplaining. I think you really hit it on the nail on the head, because if you can't apply it equally, right? So picture, if you flip the script on this, which we're going to get to in a second, because you did in this article, right? And I want to let you kind of walk through that thought experiment. But think about this. Trump stands up and says, oh, these horrible people are coming in from other countries and they've raped people and they've done this and they've done this and they've stolen and they're bad, bad hombres or whatever. And
yeah.
and then in his typical, like, oh God, Lustering. Is this really our guy kind of way. But he does all that. And then people say, well, that's you can't. And then the very people who are on the left side go, no, just because a few of these people did this,
right,
you can't color everyone with this same brush.
Right.
Right. You can't. And then now what if women who were Trump supporters started coming forward and going, I was raped by a man who was speaking Spanish, who was undocumented.
Right.
And they slit their wrists and poured it out in front of them. They would apply to that person defending Trump the argument that you're making.
Right, right.
But somehow, and I think it's the privilege equation. You can't do it, but it doesn't flip in their minds. Now, so that gets us to, in the article, you apply this to another. You did a thought experiment where what would happen if this was an African-American man from an inner city with a high crime rate that is accused of a crime by a woman, which is dangerous territory to go into.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, this is when you write an article like this, you have to go through and read every single sentence and think about what would that look like when someone takes it out of context.
Yeah.
Because
I walked into it trepidatiously.
Yeah.
Yeah. No.
So
but
walk through that thought of experiment.
Yeah. So I just think it's a good discipline in general for everyone, especially when we're so polarized, to take any situation. I really try to do this. Like, you flip it and see, well, if it's a person I'm more apt to be sympathetic toward, and then everything were reversed, how would I feel then? And try to really analyze, you know, what are your prejudices and what are you reacting to appropriately? So the thought experiment was, as you said, an African American male from an inner city with a high crime rate is accused, very sincerely soundingly, by a woman, uncorroborated, no evidence to corroborate her accusation, but she seems sincere. And women start in general, you know, flooding the courthouse or the, you know, whatever situation he's being publicly shamed in, and telling their stories of how they too were, you know, had some assailant who fit the profile of this man. And in him, they see a representation of their abuse or whatever crime it was. And that because of their pain, you know, this man has to bear the shame of it. And to not do so would be a slap in their faces, you know, a signal to them that they will never be heard. you know, all the things that we've been hearing women say, you know, I think we would all not only say that that was unfair, but also say that it was really offensive and actually pretty prejudicial that their stories mm-hmm. were being used to accuse this particular man, you know, who to them represents the scourge of inner city aggression, and apply it to, you know, have as though it had any relevancy to his guilt or innocence. So that was a thought experiment. Yeah.
And then the question is, I mean, now anyone who's listening who would be siding with the more the left of the side of things with this would say, no, you cannot. Both of those arguments, the one that I made about Trump and Latinos or Mexican immigrants or something, and the one that you made about an African-American inner city man, the difference is they are underprivileged, disenfranchised, and so they're not placeholders. So basically, we have two things happening here. We have a view that literally thinks that being logical, I mean, there's college classes about this, that being logical, believing in objective truth and trying to find evidence and come to good conclusions is basically a westernized patriarchal concept. And that somehow we can't, who's in the argument? So if I say, you know, I can say, you know, all men are mortal. Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. And it doesn't matter if I say all men are mortal. Bob is a man, therefore Bob is mortal. They would go, well, wait a minute, well, who is Bob? Where is Bob from? What has Bob's experience of power been? Or whatever. I'm like, no, we have to, here's a man, regardless of the color of his skin, regardless of his religion, who someone came up and made this uncorroborated, very, in some ways convincing, in some ways kind of weird, argument that this happened, and he vehemently denies it. And when they reached out to the people that she gave that could corroborate her story, they said, I don't remember a party like that. I don't remember ever seeing them in the same place. I don't remember being there. That's not, you know, what happened. And we take that seriously. And whereas if that was, like you said, like you looked at, if that was a line of white, rich women standing there telling their stories of being assaulted by black men in a city to kind of frame this guy, that there's no corroboration, this black man, there would be riots in the streets.
Right. Yeah, right. And I think it's an elevation of activism over truth, right? Because the principles of justice either have to adhere universally or they are there's no teeth to them. So if activism is elevated over truth, then you kind of have to be a consequentialist and any means work, right? Like your goal above truth is finding the right effect, infecting it into society. So that's not really going to be a real concern. Truth is going to be much less of a concern in that framework.
Truth is something to be used when it can be a good means to an end, and suppressed when it is not a good means to an end.
Yeah, because and the danger.
The outcome is what's important.
Yeah, and the danger that they risk, that's just what you alluded to earlier with the Trump and the hombre blustering, and you know that they really set a situation where society starts to actually buy into that way of thinking, right? And mm-hmm. Collectivizing and if you're going to have, you know, one your group be the good guys and this group be the bad guys, well, the people who are considered the bad guys are eventually going to use that, you know, same type of sort of infantile way of looking at the world back at you, you know, and that's sort of what brought Trump onto our society, right. such as he were.
And it just seems to me that we've spoken before about how it's like, you know, like I brought up the issue of like Bush back whenever, right after 9/11, he starts kind of like collecting all this power in the executive branch, kind of moving kind of the weight of power over to the executive branch. And everyone who was on the Republican side of things is just really 100% behind this because they're drank the Kool-Aid and he's the good guy. And some of us were kind of like going, hey, I'm fairly conservative, but you're kind of jumping over the Constitution here and kind of messing things up. And they're like, shut up. It's going to be good for our side. I'm like, look, whatever. It's like when you have a house. Whatever changes you make to the house, if you put a hot tub in, the people you sell it to are going to get to sit in it. Right. So you got to leave all those tools and all those upgrades there when you get evicted. Right.
Yeah.
It's like,
I've been saying this for years. Yeah. Yeah. Everyone has been doing it for years. I mean, Obama, I've got a pen and I've got a phone, you know, journalists, you know, anyway, we don't have to get in the weeds about all that. But I remember thinking, you know, someday you're not going to want this much power in the executive branch. And it's going to be when the guy you don't like's in office. And then I think we're seeing the fruits of that. But everyone overplays their hand, right? So the evangelicals were kind of overplaying their hand during the Bush years and the Iraq war. And they just felt this cultural wind behind their back. And then it's switched now. The progressives, I think, hard left are really overplaying their hand in a way that they don't realize the backlash is here. You know, the backlash already here.
Well, I was meaning more in the sense of like, kind of like in the world of rhetoric, we have had a consolidation of power in this kind of, I mean, think about how Trump got elected. He fired up the disenfranchised in his base and weaponized their anger and got it to come out, and which in some ways was that, you know, the political moves of the left applied to the right. I mean, I think there's going to be there'll be a book written after Trump where they go back and they look at Trump through the lens of Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And they'll go, he just did the left's community activism kind of thing on a national scale, right? But if we do that, if we kind of go, they've been doing it, if we step in and legitimize that kind of interaction, where, I mean, the same way that I saw those women holding open the door and yelling at Jeff Flake about you're saying that my pain means nothing and my abuse was meaningless and all that stuff. I remember seeing Trump supporters standing around Ted Cruz and he was just trying to talk to them. And he's like saying, look, I just like to explain that you're from Canada. And they just kept finishing his sentences and everybody, woo, yeah. And just throwing out these like these little slogans and shouting him down. And I'm like, dudes, I don't care if this works. This is not a tool we want to make the default tool of the political process. And they kind of did. And if we play into that same thing, it's going to permanently be that, like the big, powerful executive branch that's going to be permanently part of it. And now we're seeing that they're going, oh, you're going to play the game. Well, we can play it harder. And we're just going to send an ocean of women to stand outside the Supreme Court and just slit their wrists and just bleed all over the place and put all their pain out there and try to shame you. But we should do what you're doing is stand up as conservatives and go, no, it's wrong when they do that. And it's wrong when we do that.
Yeah. I'd be interested in seeing someone from the left do that, you know, because I feel like there's a lot of self-criticism on the right. I mean, I'm speaking broadly, obviously, but there's a big Never Trump movement. And I don't see that happen quite as much. And maybe I'm being prejudicial, but I don't see that happen quite as much as the left. I don't see them condemning that type of rhetoric. Maybe they are, and I'm not seeing it. I tried, you know, but we've talked about this before. We listen to NPR. I'm trying to give the ear to the best voices on their side. Yeah. And I really don't hear that type of condemnation. There was something that came out, I think maybe in The Atlantic or something, or when Trump first won, that was really someone intelligently saying, hey, maybe we should rethink what we've been doing with all this identity politics. And he got lambasted for it. But it was a good moment of self-reflection. But it would be fascinating for me and wonderful to see that happen more.
Yeah. And it's, well, there's a article, what is this in? Someone posted this the other day. It's in the Independent Whig. It's a British thing. And this writer, I don't know how to say his last name. It's Hidt. Hade.
Okay.
It's an excerpt from a book of his called The Righteous Mind. And he's, from what I heard, what the person that linked this to me, I haven't read this yet, but the person that linked it, I really respect. And they said that this guy is a person on the left who makes the claim that people on the right understand people on the left far better than people on the left understand the people on the right.
Oh, that's definitely true. I mean, generally speaking, that's utterly my experience. And it makes sense, right? Culturally, we are a leftist country.
I don't think that we can see, I don't think that a lot of the people who were making this argument, throwing these ocean of stories that weren't relevant about this particular man and this particular woman, are able to step back and look at that. Because they just look at someone based on their intersectionality and their privilege and go, that is a bad guy.
Yeah.
And so this is how we treat bad guys. We shout them down. They don't get to talk. We protest when they try to come on our college campus. We shout them down and we do whatever it takes to shut them up because they're Nazis and they don't get to talk. Right. But I think we saw this elevated to the level of blood sport because let's be honest, this whole thing is about Roe. That's what this is about. It's about Roe versus Wade.
It is. And I think it's just been something brewing for a long time as well. But yeah, I think this particular outburst is probably mostly about Roe. The Supreme Court has become so all powerful. I mean, that, you know, that's a whole other conversation. Inappropriately so, so people, that's the golden branch now.
Well, in some ways it is, but it's, what's weird is that, I mean, we are kind of getting in the weeds now, but like, so Bush started, then Obama finished a deep consolidation of power in the executive branch.
Yeah.
And then Congress just stopped doing its job in any real way.
Yeah.
So the legislative branch just stopped doing doing legislation. And so something had to kind of balance. I mean, there's a system of checks and balances, right? So if you make this too light and you make this overly heavy and you don't want the whole thing to fall, something has to get heavier to balance it. And that's become the activism from the bench of the Supreme Court. And so there's been kind of a continue, but it's interesting though, because the left has put, this is something we can agree on. The left has put a ton of effort and a ton of rhetoric and fundraising around getting things like Obergefell and to the Supreme Court so that change can come through the bench, right? And then on the political right, and especially on the religious right, one could argue that the bulk of the social agenda on the right is about abortion, and that what we think would need to happen about abortion is we need to get Roe overturned by the Supreme Court. So both sides are defined by trying to get a control of this overly powerful tool. And I think this came to a head.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's a real, it leads to a lot of toxicity, right? Because people don't feel that they have much of a voice if they vote in one law and then, you know, vote in support of one law and then the Supreme Court just comes in and overturns it. And so it sort of weaponizes the Supreme Court and also entrenches people on both sides in a way that's pretty detrimental to civilization, our civilization. Yeah.
I think that's what I think is so frightening about, I mean, I've haven't been a big supporter of Trump for the most part. I've been in favor of a few of the outcomes that have happened, but I think that we have consistently, I think that his rhetoric and the rhetoric that people are starting to use following him is a hitting back with the strength and in the same manner as what we've seen from the left. And now they're coming back with more of that. And I think that is making us more and more and more and more divided in a way that we just assumed that they couldn't possibly step back and understand an argument. And they assumed that we can't do anything other than exercise power and privilege. And so we just end up with, well, what we've seen, we see a blunt use of power to get the Supreme Court, both with them refusing to hold hearings on Merrick Garland, and then now cramming this through despite objections. On the left, you've got just people willing to do whatever kind of guerrilla warfare, whatever people do when they have to fight when they don't have power, whatever kind of guerrilla warfare they have to do, because this, everything rides on this.
Yeah, it's a pretty bleak picture you're drawing. I find my hope barometer has gone down a lot as you've been saying that. But it does feel like it's continuous escalation. And, you know, also contributing to that is that we've kind of made politics our national religion.
Yeah.
We've talked about this before. I think in a way the evangelicals were sort of in general quick to do that, because not that our own Catholic Church doesn't have intensely corrupting problems, but they were, for different reasons, I think, quicker to make politics the religion. And then I think the secularization of America has led to that as well too, right? People are in mediating institutions are much less effective and broken, and so it just sort of becomes this almost like search for a utopia, and it starts bearing like all the hallmarks of like a fundamentalism about it, right?
Oh, it's totally a fundamentalism. I mean, when you see and it's not even just on the right. Look at like left-wing comedians.
I was thinking of both sides for sure.
Yeah, to go to a college campus. It's like everyone, it seems like fundamentalism and activist fundamentalism has become the mode of engagement in the world. And for playing the drinking game at home, you have to drink. I use the phrase mode of engagement.
It goes back to that thing we were talking about earlier, that if activism is elevated above truth, it becomes like a dogmatic fundamentalism, because and with this whole Kavanaugh situation, you see that you can look at flip the switch situation, like in the thought experiment we were doing. And if you can't see that the principle of justice has to apply universally, you don't really have a principle of justice. You have a sort of a religious belief that's not guided by reason. That is sort of a fundamentalist scenario.
And I think that there needs to be kind of, if we pull back a little bit and we look at this, I think there needs to be a stance that I think there's a deeper problem on the right and the left. I think it's a problem in modern society, is that we've all become ideologues, in the sense that we see everything through the lens of something else. And reality no longer has its place as the goal that we're trying to get to, and the thing that the rock that we have to break our experience against to see if it matches. We're not there anymore.
Yeah. The antidote to it, I wrote something else for the Federalist. I don't know if you read it. Virtues. They titled it something about virtue signaling, which was not my title, but it was kind of talking about this too, just that I think the less self-reflective and intellectually and spiritually formed we are, the more likely we are to be ideologues.
Right, I'll try to find that and I'll link them both in the show notes.
What else of my work can I reference self-servingly? I've also done this.
Most of my listeners have heard almost everything you've written. For a while there, you were just like putting something out every week, and I was like and now for the Noel Maring Report, my friend put out yet another great article. But I think that I guess another thing that I just kind of want to think about, and I'd like to get your take on, is the, you know, what's interesting. It's like we're going through this cultural moment where we're kind of, how to say it, we're doing two things at once. We're both on the positive side. We're looking at a bunch of things that we've lost that used to be part of culture or nature and recreating them by art. But at the same time, because we've gotten civilization has changed so much so quickly that we're now taking this moment to look back on and to kind of evaluate where we've been, which normally was kind of the work of historians looking back on a different generation. But now we've entered this strange place where we're judging our younger selves and younger versions of other people around us and their actions and the evidence around their actions by a standard that we now have that wouldn't have occurred to anyone. I mean, for example, if I said, what was it the other day? I just a little while ago, I saw a headline. I didn't read the article, but it was a headline that Arnold Schwarzenegger, apologizes for using the phrase girly men earlier in his life. I'm not making this up. This is on a headline right now.
It's and now like, he will bear the shame of that.
Right. I mean, we're 6 to 10 years away from someone saying, this person wants to be on the Supreme Court, but we see here that a collective look at their language and all of their writings, they have only used he and she pronouns, which displays that they have been imposing a gender binary on reality this entire time. Oh, well, but we can't have that. He, in 1982, he was using only he and she pronouns. He's horrible. I mean,
Z is horrible.
And Zal won't handle it. I mean, it's like,
how dare you?
Zal will brook no dissent from this. It's just nuts, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
But I mean, when you look now, so then when you look at this, I mean, I want to kind of break down the last thing I want to talk about is, I think that look, there is lest we sound like we don't take this stuff seriously. There was the sexual revolution explodes. The normal kind of like historical rules surrounding men and women immediately come crashing down, and we're having to kind of work all this out. Right.
Right.
I saw this video of Jordan Peterson being asked over and over again, do you think that women and men can work in the same workplace? And these things, now he said, oh, well, we just don't know. It's a 40-year experiment. We're only 40 years into this experiment. We're going to have to wait and see. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, think about that. We're 40 years into an experiment of men and women engaging in the same kind of work in the same place and all this. So I think that same kind of thing, when I look back to the early 80s, 1982 is when this happened, or was allegedly happened. I was 12 years old. So I can remember, he was 17, he's 5 years older than me. I can remember all the movies he's referencing, like they were trying to make their yearbook look like Porky's and Fast Times at Ridgemont High and Caddyshack.
Oh, yeah. That was the culture. Oh.
Totally it was. And it's like you're looking back and you're, so this guy, we're looking back on 17-year-old guy. Now I'm sure even if something did happen between him and this woman, I'm not sure that the way she's remembering it is correct. And I'm not sure that we can hold 17-year-old Brett Kavanaugh accountable for like him at 17. Mostly spending all his time on sports and drinking, sounds like, trying to figure out what's awkward and what's acceptable or whatever, when he's imitating the stuff that the music videos and the movies are telling you is like really cool, you know, which that it's just, I don't know. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I'm just rambling.
Yeah, no, I totally see what you're saying. And I want to say outright that I'm agnostic about what actually happened between the two of them, because I think we have to be because of the lack of corroborating evidence. But yeah, the culture was certainly different. And I think that men and boys got away with things that they would never get away with now. And I think you're right to pinpoint on that being right on the heels of the social upheaval from the sexual revolution. And, you know, all of a sudden sex is meaningless. There's no objective meaning to our bodies. And it's just, you know, whatever we want, except for, we've talked about this ad nauseum in the past, about all pinned on the loose hinge of consent. But yet people have this, rightfully so, this feeling that it does mean something more, right? Like, if it's not just like bowling with someone, otherwise you would never say he forced me to bowl with him and be super traumatized, right? Sex does mean something different. But certainly the culture was different. If we knew, you know, I would have to really think, if we knew for a fact that he had done something, and even if she interpreted differently, like, you know, there was a rest, I don't know. It's hard to even speculate about that, because it just would change the equation. I think that he would have to step down, obviously. Like, he wouldn't have been, if there were some smoking gun or some type of corroboration.
But then the question is that, like, I mean, like I said, you know, you go back to the early 80s and you're at a party and everyone's drinking, and maybe you've been at parties and you've seen, you know, people, he called it like rough horse play or something, right? I mean, if you've seen those kinds of things, and seen everyone on both sides of the gender divide acting like they were perfectly fine and perfectly fun and everything, how are you? I just don't.
There's a culpability. Yeah, there's a culpability dilution there, right?
Right.
What you're saying, I think.
Well, I don't, but I am agnostic about whether or not something happened. I don't get the feeling. I guess maybe I'm wearing my hunch on my sleeve. I don't get the feeling in any way that Brett Kavanaugh actually intended to and tried to rape this woman, and he was so drunk that he couldn't get the job done. I just don't. That isn't what comes out of the evidence as we see it for me. Now, did something happen? Were they at the same party? Maybe. Did something happen to her at a party with that bunch of douchey white guys that went to the private school? I mean, maybe.
Yeah.
But
there's a presumption of innocence that isn't, even though this wasn't a trial, it's still a principle of common fairness, right?
I would like to think that. But I mean, look at where we got in this. There was a point where a letter was sent to a newspaper with no name on the letter, with no return address, making an argument that something happened at some point in time with Brett Kavanaugh, and it was talked about and published and considered as if it was another accusation, quote unquote.
Right, right.
Could you imagine?
It was totally an irresponsible carrying of those stories by the newspapers. I mean, that such an egregious irresponsibility. And I think it really, you know, there's a major backlash against that. And it did that Brett Kavanaugh a big favor that they ran with those stories. You know, I think one of them, the woman actually ended up saying, I think she accused him of gang rape. And then she kept changing some of her story. And then she finally said, well, I saw him handing out red Solo cups. And that was maybe evidence that he roofied someone, you know. I mean, it just got more and more bizarre. But
right, and it's like, how many people of both genders over the course of history has handed out red Solo cups? I mean,
yeah, we've evidently all roofied someone at this point then.
Right. It's just I mean, when there's blood in the water and there's a blood sport going on, then, well, to mix my blood metaphors here, then you just kind of go for it, and you hope that if you throw enough, you know, libelous spaghetti against the wall, some of it'll stick. Now, there's a question. You brought up an interesting question. I want you to explore this just a little bit further. So this wasn't a trial. This was a job interview for all practical purposes. And so the question is, well, is there a presumption of innocence? And I think that you're right to say that that is a certain a principle within society, our society, where in general, if someone doesn't have to prove their innocence, someone else has to prove they're guilty, even outside of a court of law. Is that what you were kind of trying to say?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, is there much worse than being having the whole country think that you're a rapist? I mean, even if it was just a job interview or just the defamation, utter defamation. They were speculating in some newspapers too, he should never be coaching sports again for his daughter's school. And
right.
I mean, it's just, yeah, it's a level of defaming someone that is unheard of, at the scale, the scope.
And the amount of people that I heard saying it doesn't matter if he did it because X, Y, or Z, they're willing to destroy someone and they're like, oh, boohoo, he has a lot of money. He's privileged, so he shouldn't. Right. Who cares?
Feel bad for him.
Who cares if he never gets to coach his daughter's basketball team again? You know, we're out here trying to keep you people from trampling on our rights, so we'll do whatever it takes, right? I mean, that's the mentality to it. I just think we have to stand up against this kind of thing, no matter whose side does it. So if the next time this happens, it's the sharks are in the water, are Republican sharks, then we need to stand up and scream and yell too.
Yeah.
which I have. I have too.
I think that we both have a track record of being utterly willing to call out people from our side. This is not a partisan fight for me, or you, but I feel like they're hurting their movement, and I'm, for women who have suffered this type of abuse, really doesn't do them any good to have this weaponized in such a partisan battle, because it entrenches people and it undercuts the validity of the movement.
Well, and that's what I was trying to, I was kind of awkwardly trying to get to the redefining of things that happened in 1982 and making it sound like someone could take me as saying that I think that these things are okay. No, you shouldn't have sex until you're married anyway. You shouldn't, kids shouldn't be in a room by themselves. I mean, when I was in eighth, ninth grade and we're like, parents are technically home, but they're upstairs and we're all in a basement listening to Air Supply and making out. No, that was a bad idea. We shouldn't have been doing it anyway. Right. I mean, playing spin the ball.
At least not to Air Supply. At least not to Air Supply.
Okay. REO Speedwagon. I still get a special feeling every time I hear, I can't stop. I can't fight this feeling anymore.
Yeah. No, that's got sentimental value for me as well.
But I think I guess what I'm saying is that we have to, if we start making awkward adolescent interactions the same thing as rape, it's kind of like the left keeps using the word hate. And I've said this over and over again, you say that I am wrong because I identify as an androgyne porpoise. Well, that's hate. And I'm like, I always say, well, buddy, I really hope that I hope we don't need that word, because you're really deflating that word. I hope that you never experience actual hate in this world. I hope we don't need that word, because you're making it mean nothing. In the same way, a word like rape. I mean, this has been an overall with Title IX stuff and everything. It's like, I mean, if we take rape and we start making this rape and that rape, and we start kind of keep taking this word and making it mean something less and less and less than what it used to mean, or more and more and more than what it used to mean, we don't have that word anymore, right? We can't carry the weight of the travesty of that thing happening anymore. Like, or any of these things. And I start hearing if we react to this modern movement where every little thing is starting to be kind of drug out and displayed as assault, then you're really letting the people who actually committed assault off the hook in a way.
Yeah. Everything kind of becomes fodder for advancing your narrative, right? Regardless of the truth of it.
And I think that, I guess that there's people out there who have experienced such horrible, horrible, horrible abuse.
Yeah.
And we want to stand up with them, right?
Right. And we want to stand up for them. I mean, this is harming them in two ways, right? Because it's harming them. It undercuts their movement, but it also is not helping them personally either. You know, I think that's why Jordan Peterson gets so much traction, because, so social psychology and also our own natures tell us that we can feed two narratives in our minds. We can feed the narratives where we've been hurt and where we're nursing our fragility and our frailties, or we can feed the narrative of us overcoming something and us, you know, and being, having some personal responsibility for, okay, this might've happened to me, but where do I go from here? Mm-hmm. And the more we feed that, it's the more it's naturally empowering for you. Mm-hmm. And so this whole sort of trumpeting of your victimization. And I know that, you know, that might bristle with my friends on the left because, you know, it seems like a scapegoat, but it is a culture of nursing your victimization. I've even felt it myself. Like I thought, maybe I should appeal to something bad that's happened to me in order to have a leg to stand on, you know, and,
right.
And you too, I know you've spoken publicly that you're a survivor of abuse. The fact that we do have to appeal to those things is, I get it, but it's also, there's something strange about it, right? Because it's sort of saying, like, I could say the exact same thing and then copy and paste it and put it in the mouth of someone else. And it would either have more or less weight, not based on the argument, but based on the speaker. Right. Which is sort of a strange place to be in.
Yeah, I've tried to, you know, as this narrative has moved forward, I've tried to like kind of stop. I brought that out on my podcast and started talking about my abuse experience because I just wanted, it felt like the moment to do it. And then this all happened and I've mentioned it a couple of times and I've been kind of conscious about like, am I accidentally throwing that phrase out so that I have the right to speak or something? And I'm like, And that's something I don't want to do. I don't want to use something that happened to me to gain me the credibility to be heard or something.
I don't think you've done that. And I didn't mean to imply that you're doing that.
No, but I feel you were saying something that I've thought to myself, and I'm like, it seems to me that, I guess what I was trying to say earlier is that if someone confused, think about like guys, bullying some kid, and treating him like hell and like beating him up in a locker room versus a bunch of guys snapping each other with towels. Now, maybe I've seen a situation where there was a kid that was smaller than everyone else and he was in the towel fight and he felt like he had to be in the towel fight or whatever. And then he felt really out of control and he felt kind of bullied by the towel fight.
Mm-hmm.
A bunch of guys that are used to having towel fights, you can't really go, hey, you need to realize. I mean, you can't look back on that. Now we can. When you're a grown up, you can. And if you're a grown up watching that happen, if you're a coach, you come in and step in and go, boys, come on. And maybe you pull them aside and go, dude, he's way small. Do you not see he's way smaller than you? He might experience that differently. But to compare towel snapping to someone being, held down and punched over and over again. Those are two really different things, right? And I feel like we're kind of heading down a road where we're kind of starting to use the same word for all those kind of things when it comes to the sexual arena.
Yeah, you see that with the discussion around catcalling or women get offended when someone says to smile or something, right. Which I get that those things are not great, but there's certainly degrees, right? But I think even saying that, I'm cringing a little bit because I think that I'd get jumped on by the speaking police or PC police. I don't know.
Of course. I mean, should men, catcall women and whistle at them when they walk by? No. Have I ever done that? I don't think so. I don't think I've. When I hear people when I believe my female friends who tell me that that happens, and I'm like, okay, well, yeah, I don't run with guys who do that. And I haven't really ever ran with guys like that. Like, there's the irony is that if I knew Brett Kavanaugh in high school, I would have hated him. That isn't who I ran with. Right. So
you wouldn't have hung out with PJ and Squee.
I wouldn't have been part of PJ and Squee. I don't think
they're doing keg stands.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever done a keg stand. I've drank too much and done stupid stuff, but I've never done a keg stand. And so I think that I wouldn't mind doing a keg stand. I mean, it'd be, it is a bucket list thing, but I just think that when we're looking back on both, when we're looking back historically and we're looking across the entire realm of action and interaction between the sexes, we need to kind of keep our wits about us and keep a striation of naming these things in a way so that when something that is really out of bounds happens, we have a word that goes with that.
That's right. Yeah. Yep. I agree with that.
Well, good.
You know, and I think that if all this happened the way that she's claimed it did, then I don't think that that's a minor thing. Obviously, that would be a serious thing to contend with. But your larger point is just generally, we're kind of escalating all of our rhetoric so that everything seems so intensely extreme that it sort of makes everything flattened, right? There's little without nuance, you don't have a real way to condemn the really bad behavior. So
right, it's like it doesn't matter what side you're on or what side you're arguing with. When you start comparing the other side to Nazis,
right,
you've probably lost the argument. That's kind of the rhetorical version of jumping the shark. I don't care if there's a similarity, if they came for the guns or if they started making thought police or whatever. When you start equating what's happening here with the Holocaust, then you've usually lost your argument. So there's a big, big, big to 11 example. But then there's a question of like, okay, look, words mean something. Words that go along with actions mean something. And if we stop, I guess that's what I'm trying to say is
that's right. Yeah.
If
that's
we
right.
stop trying to be careful about letting our language have the nuance to describe the full scale of human action, even in fractions, then we lose something and we can be less accurate in calling people to account.
That's right. Because the way words we use affect the way that we think, right? And so we start thinking about things without nuance once we're speaking about them without, and it happens on both sides. It's a nonpartisan affliction.
It is. It does seem like, and we need to probably wrap this up pretty soon here, but I think that, you know, there's that in the opening of, a forward to On the Incarnation by St. Athanasius on St. Vladimir Press. C.S. Lewis wrote the introduction to this. And in that, you see this thing bundled sometimes as On the Reading of Old Books as its own essay. And he says that we should always read an old book for every new book that we read, not because the ancients don't make mistakes. It's just that they're less likely to make the same mistakes we're making.
Hmm.
And that they're,
no, that's good.
And we're more likely to be able to see clearly their mistakes. Right. And so he says, because there's something that you, basically he says, there's something that you and your enemy both take for granted, or you and the other side both take for granted, that is wrong. Right?
That's right. That's right. We can be slaves. If that's a Chesterton quote, we can all end up being slaves to our age. If we're, you know, not in thinking with history or even thinking as, I'll remember it later. You can put it in your show notes, but yeah, it does seem like thought has, there are fads to it and it just trickles down like a fad where we think and speak in a certain way in lockstep. And you get the sense that people are not really, everyone can fall into it, but it's not a thoughtful way to live.
Well, I think that what I was trying to get at is this activist way of engaging reality, this activist way of engaging politics, this and the different all the different species of that, the identity politics, the analogical politics, the cultivation of outrage, and then that collapsing of meaning of words to encompass a much, much, much broader scale. I mean, if you wanted to be ridiculous, I mean, it could be, we could say, oh, well, you know, he drank a lot. And when we look into it, it's like, well, he was always really well hydrated. He drank a lot of water. Well, if you're going to change the meaning of the phrase drank a lot implies it was alcohol that he was drinking. So if we want to be able to describe the problem of alcoholism, we should probably reserve the phrase drank a lot to beverages that would intoxicate, right? We don't
want,
you know, oh, he was just drinking all the time, right? You know, there's a silly example. But I think that that's part of the 16 things that we're doing wrong, that we're doing wrong on both sides. It just in the realm of being nonpartisan, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Well.
Right.
It's always good.
Yeah,
it's always good having someone on. Oh, go ahead. You had one more thing, Sally.
No. I was just going to say, my phone's close to dying, so I think we were going to wrap this up.
the limits of modern interviews here. Well, this has been fun. It's like, I'm anytime I can sit down and talk to you, there's certain people in my world that if I could see them every day and just sit and have a candid conversation with them. And obviously this is kind of a public conversation. But which makes it kind of awkward, and you're kind of like, oh, do I really want to say that? You know, it's part of what I want to do when I do interviews on my podcast is to model what it means to try to think through something through conversation, even if we're both completely wrong about what we're saying.
Yeah.
And if people misunderstand what we're trying to say, just to kind of model that this is what conversation looks like, you know?
Yeah.
Hence, you know, I talk a little more than most interviewers because I'm trying to record a conversation, you know? All right. Well, Noelle, it's been a blast. We should have done this a long time ago, and we should do it more frequently. So thanks for coming out.
That sounds great. This has been a lot of fun. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. So we went a little long, and so we're just going to go ahead and wrap it up. And I want to thank everybody for coming out. And let's pull the plug, pop the cork on another episode of The Whaley Show. See you next time. I'm a fish with no
bowl that I outgrew. Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media. Find more about us at breadboxmedia.com.